and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, February 11th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, we're bringing you a segment of our first Off the Hill political panel of the year, which took place last night, Thursday, February 10th. Last night's theme, Whose Budget Is It Anyway? Co-hosting last night's event was former NDP Deputy Leader and House Leader Libby Davies and founder of the 613-819 Black Hub, Robin Brown. Our special guests included MP Leah Gazan, poet and scholar L. Jones, Senior Economist at Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, David MacDonald, and Rabble's own national senior politics reporter, Carl Nirenberg. Our panelists deconstructed the federal budget to help us understand why is it important and what power does the government really have in designing a federal budget. They also zeroed in on recent events in Ottawa, such as the ousting of Conservative leader Erin O'Toole and the so-called Freedom Convoy, and the visible rise in right-wing populism. It was a fiery panel. Here's a snippet from last night's event. Take a listen.
Looking at that, I also want to bring it back now to what's gone on Parliament Hill and turn to Leah, because obviously, Leah, you've been there. And we know that at the beginning of the week, the NDP leader, Jagmeet Singh, called for an emergency debate in Parliament. And that actually did take place. We've seen the stories on that. And his call for an emergency debate was on the convoy crisis affecting people across the country. He's asked the Prime Minister to show leadership to put an end to the convoy, to investigate the funding. That's a very big issue, this $10+ million that's funding the convoy, and to work on a plan to get Canadians through the pandemic. So just interested in your take, Leah, in what was the tone of that emergency debate? Because we know that the Conservatives, many of them have been, showing their solidarity with what's happening on the street. So very, very interested to know how you saw that emergency debate and what came out of it.
Well, I think it's really important first to recognize this is not a protest. This is an occupation that has been well orchestrated and funded by alt-right fascists from the United States. We saw, for example, GoFundMe raise over $10 million in 8 days. And this is what they do. We are at a time in history where we're in deep recession. People are struggling. And this is what alt-right movements do. They play on people's suffering, at times a struggle, and they feed off that misery and they build movements of hate. That's what happened in the Second World War. That's how we had a Holocaust during the Second World War. We need to have a real discussion about it. And, you were like right out there. But, I agree with you. They are doing exactly what they were designed to do. And they are using left struggles to provide messages for this movement. This is not an uprising for the working class. It's anti-worker, in fact. Like, they took 1,500 people, they closed down a mall, resulting in 1,500 people being unable to work. You have 4,800 cases in front of ESDC of truckers that have not been paid. This is not about workers. This is not about truckers. This is about a rising alt-right white supremacist movement that is well funded by the United States. The NDP called on investigating GoFundMe, where the money was coming from. But let's get real. GoFundMe was shut down. They raised $8 million through a Christian charity site. So we've called for an investigation on that, for a banning of hate symbols. The fact that people were calling it a peaceful protest, I don't think using you know, flying Confederate flags and swastikas, you know, harassing people in Winnipeg Center, for example, in my riding, where a convoy has now sprung up, that is right beside bus shelters where people live in minus 45, the only shelter for members of the unsheltered community, now have blaring horns in their ears, including train horns. There is nothing peaceful about it. I find it deeply concerning that residents, for example, in my riding, have called the non-emergency line about complaints about, you know, about noise to be hung up on. And occupiers at the legislature talking about how they have, I have it in quotes, we are in complete unity with them. I think Elle is right. I think they're doing exactly what they've been designed to do. And we are at a critical juncture. We have a moment to look honestly at systems and how systems that have been put in place to oppress. Let's not forget, and I've spoken about this in other panels, the reason we have an RCMP in this country was to remove violently Indigenous peoples off their land. That's why we have it. We have Wet'suwet'en territory where they use sniper guns, where they literally used an axe and a chainsaw, to break down the door of two peaceful women living out their rights on unceded territory, an axe and a chainsaw. Two people, force, normalize violence against Indigenous women and girls, and they can't figure out how to get people to behave and not overtake a whole city. I've been in Ottawa. I live close to downtown. And it's not just the horns that drive you crazy. It's that visceral hate. It's that dangerous level of white supremacy. I'm proud that our party has called particularly for an investigation on where this is being funded. We had Ted Cruz giving it a thumbs up. Donald Trump giving a thumbs up. If we narrowed this conversation to just the Ottawa police, this is a bigger issue that we see brewing across the country, and it is a time of reckoning. And we can choose to move forward in a way that speaks truth to what's going on and develop systems that aren't going to oppress people and be used to keep the most marginalized people in this country that have dealt with oppression down. So I feel as passionately about Elle about this. It was music to my ears. It's the time for real talk.
Leah, in terms of the response from, you know, officialdom in Ottawa, Parliament, the Prime Minister, at least it seemed to us from afar here on the West Coast, the response of the Prime Minister was really sort of very passive. He kind of disappeared for a while. I don't know how it played out in that emergency debate, but have you been surprised by the lack of proactivity by the government of Canada itself, personified by the Prime Minister and his government? They've been very slow to react.
100%. So the Prime Minister has made a couple of speeches and then he's gone missing. Like, where's the leadership here? But we need leadership across the board. The fact that we have Pierre Poilievre, who's come out as a conservative candidate, talking about, you know, picking up on the Freedom Convoy, talking about how he's going to fight for people's freedom, or the fact that Candace Bergen, the current leader of the Conservative Party, tried to compare Indigenous people burning down churches after discovering deceased children who were murdered in residential schools to what is going on in the occupation in Ottawa. That has been the discourse, and that has been a normalized discourse, whether it's now during the occupation or during since the colonization of this country. It's a normalized discourse that we really need to reconcile with. You know, we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We say there's no truth without justice. I'm going to the first meeting of the inquest on a young Aisha Hudson, a 15-year-old girl who was shot in the head by police in Winnipeg. The first day of witnesses as we move into an inquest to support her family tomorrow. Excessive force. A force that was never really properly investigated, to the point where they're calling for an inquiry led by great legal minds like Murray Sinclair. This is not in our heads. And I think now is the time where we, I think more people are waking up to this. I know, Al, before this, you spoke about your mom talking about defunding the police, people to really look at our systems and why our systems were designed in the first place and how they continue to perpetuate violence and how that violence is supported by people in power who are privileged from that violence. So mm-hmm. I'll leave it there. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you for that, Leah. That's actually a really great segue, what you said about that this is about more than the police. So I want to actually go to David, but to premise this with, so Judy Rebick wrote an article in Rabble, where she was talking about the fact that we have to understand why this is getting so much support. And she was critiquing both there's legitimate critiques of the government response to the pandemic and legitimate critiques of the left's response to the pandemic and not supporting workers, that kind of stuff. So David, just this kind of a segue into the question to you, as our economist on the panel, what connections could or should we make between the events of the last 2 weeks in Ottawa and an upcoming federal budget with those critiques from Judy in mind?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the upcoming budget will likely be later than budgets generally are, just given the pre-budget consultation timing. Usually the MPs are interested in submissions for the budget over the course of the late summer. They're doing that actually right now. And so it's substantially later than you would usually do it. Usually the federal budget would be out at the end of March, mid-March, early April, around March break. When students are out, it will likely be later in April, just given the timelines this year. And so if, you know, it's unlikely that the budget will have any particular impact on it. Of course, the budget's a financial document. I mean, sometimes it's about policy, but it's often about financial pieces and how much new policies might cost. And so it's tough to see how the federal budget would impact on this. I mean, it's probably 2 months away. I mean, I expect after two more months of occupation that something will happen. You know, some of the ways the federal government is likely to see some sort of financial or give some financial support to this, well, to residents rather, I mean, not to the truckers, obviously, would be additional help for the businesses that are closed. You know, there are programs in place that were meant to support businesses during the pandemic. They are much narrower now in focus towards tourism, food and hospitality businesses. And so actually many of the businesses that have been closed down by the occupation would likely still have access to these programs in the sense that they'd seen revenue fall and they're likely in these industries in any event. But these have already been budgeted for, so they're relatively minor. The workers that are working downtown and missing pay because they can't go to work, they would likely already be eligible for the lockdown benefit, which is a very small $300 a week amount that they could get if they couldn't get EI. This is sort of a CERB afterthought that's already in place. And Ottawa is so small, or the applicants are relatively small compared to the budget for this program, that even if you did see more applicants from Ottawa, it probably wouldn't make that much difference, frankly, in the aggregate cost. I mean, the other thing that is probable is that either the federal or provincial governments or both will support the cost to the city of Ottawa of additional cops coming to Ottawa. Now, again, I mean, these are very minor amounts from the perspective of the federal government. I mean, this won't affect the federal government's deficit or debt or budget really in any way, just because it's so minor. The issue here is not money. I mean, the issue here is leadership. And I mean, it's also a question, El was talking about this earlier, was, there will be large expenditures. I mean, from the perspective of the city, there'll be large expenditures on police for the occupation. But I mean, the real question is more money the problem here? Like, is that the problem? Is that we just don't have enough money to end the occupation? Or is this about, leadership and some vision of how laws actually apply to people as opposed to, that apply evenly across different groups of people as opposed to applying differently from one group to the other. That being said, this will be an important budget. It'll be the first budget after an election, even though that election seems like a long time ago. There's a fair amount of negotiation that I expect is going to happen between the Liberals and one other party, potentially the NDP. Maybe Leah can give us a a preview or insight into that. There are substantial issues that continue to occur in Canada that require federal government intervention, besides the occupation in Ottawa. You know, things like the backlog in surgery, extension of long-term care standards across the country, rebuilding of our healthcare systems to make it more resilient against future waves of COVID-19. I mean, these are critical things that need to happen. This occupation from a fiscal perspective is essentially irrelevant from the federal government's perspective. But that doesn't say there's lots of important things in the budget. But I know this is more about the occupation than about other things. I'm interested, you know, this is just to throw it to other people, as I'm interested to hear, you know, whether this is a fiscal problem. Is the problem that there isn't enough money going to the city of Ottawa and Ottawa police?
Oh, well, that's the police argument. And Carl and I were talking about this beforehand, that no matter what the issue is, the police will always say they need more money. So the police are caught racially profiling people. Well, we need more money. We need to get more minority officers. The police are caught killing people. Well, we need more money. We need to train people. We need anti-bias training. The police are caught, not processing civilian complaints. Oh, we need more money. We need a civilian person. When I presented the report into defunding, the rhetoric the police started using was that we need police for hate crimes and sexual assault. And then the example they used and they showed their PowerPoint was how they helped a little Black boy who went missing in North Preston. And it was very weaponized against me, right? As a Black woman saying, here's a report that very specifically lays out the ways that we can very practically think about beginning to disinvest from the police, not just financially, but also ideologically in society, right? That we can have that shift into thinking in new ways about how we deal with social health, what is wellness, what is actual public safety. And they immediately went to like, well, what about hate crimes? Well, I don't know, but the convoy people have sent hate crime emails into my inbox and I don't see any police helping with that. So I think the police will always say that they need more money and they shift their rhetoric. If it's not Black on Black crime, then it's suddenly that they're helping us not, you know, now the police are somehow an anti-racist force, right? So we know that the police are going to say that this is an example of why they need more personnel, but we know what their budget actually goes into. It goes into overtime salaries. 90% of the police budget goes into like salaries. It doesn't go into policing. Like, and again, so this shows us that it doesn't matter how much police you have, how much money is dumped on them, how many resources they have far more resources than any other part of society because they have been the only part of society that has been radically resourced for decades. As you've talked about, we've defunded healthcare to the point that we don't even have emergency rooms that can handle COVID. We've defunded education. We've defunded unions. We've defunded literally everything, some of which is what's leading to the crisis. And as Carl was talking about and Leah was talking about, this is where right-wing populism lives, right? This is where they take legitimate issues of social crisis and then push towards fascism. It's the immigrants that are the problem. It's the brown people that are the problem. Like, that is always what right-wing populism rests upon. And so we've been seeing this very radical social shift, particularly since the 1970s, to completely disinvest from everything in public and then just use the police to fill the gaps. So what we're actually seeing, I would suggest, is not going to be solved by more money to police, because more money to police continues the problem of disinvesting from collective social systems, which is why people are alienated, which is why people feel that government does nothing for them. And this is why we have these violent uprisings. It's why young people aren't voting, because they're like, it doesn't make a difference what I vote for. We talked in our report about participatory budgeting and returning budgets to the people, which doesn't really work on a federal level, obviously, but on a municipal level, there's many models where people get to say, hey, if we take this money from police, what in my community is actually keeping people safe? What is actually working? What programs are in my community and actually putting money there and reinvesting people in these systems? So I think we also have to think a lot about how disengaged we become from each other's society, how we've normalized a completely violent state. And I don't just mean through policing. I mean, the violent loss of jobs, the loss of businesses. People are living very precarious lives. And if we're not careful, yes, it tips over into right-wing populism. So our job is to really make sure that we are advocating for money to go back to workers, to go back into unions, to go back into communities. And that means we have to stop spending it on the military and police. And we have to actually put it into economies of care instead.
So, Al, I'm going to jump in there, and I think both you and David have made a really good connection about how what's happening in Ottawa is connected to the budget. It is, because a budget is about leadership, as you said, David. It is about making choices that is, you know, about the health and well-being of Canadians or not. and we're living the consequences of failed earlier budgets. And I'd like to bring in Carl now, because of course we've got another element of this big story that's unfolding in Ottawa, and that is the resignation of Erin O'Toole, the now former leader of the Conservative Party. And Leah, you mentioned Pierre Poilievre, an Ottawa area member of parliament who's already announced his candidacy for the leadership of the Conservative Party. So Carl, you follow these things very closely. The question, you know, what impact is Poilievre going to have on the Conservative Party itself and on Canadian politics overall, given his history that's very provocative in his politics? Is it a further indication, I guess, of sort of the radicalized conservative politics that we see taking place?
So you talked about right-wing populism. And, you know, if we look at the American model that we're seeing full-blown and in full bloom, you have the populist leader who seeks to get some justification from a notional democratic process, hugely flawed. And when the democratic process isn't necessarily or automatically going to give him power, he seeks to change the democratic process. So what they're doing in the States is seeking to corrupt the democratic process that's already pretty corrupt and corrupt it even more to nullify the votes of millions of people or to prevent them from voting to make sure the right person gets elected. At the same time, if you look at the history of, I mean, another term for right-wing populism in Europe is fascism. That is, fascism started especially in the country that gave birth to that name, Italy. Mussolini was a socialist at one time. And what they do and what Poilievre's strategy will be is to have a two-pronged strategy to intimidate the forces of so-called moderate democratic bourgeois order, if we can use old-fashioned language, with activities like the activities we're seeing in Ottawa in the streets.
That was a clip from our live politics panel, which took place last night on Thursday, February 10th. Thanks to all who tuned in and to our wonderful guests for their insight. If you missed last night's events and would have liked to attend, you can always catch us next time. Our next Off the Hill event will take place Thursday, March 10th, 2022. Ahead of the March panel, don't forget to register so you can have your chance to interact with our panelists through questions, polls, and more. Subscribe to our weekly email for details at rabble.ca. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Rabble continues its coverage on the ongoing Freedom Convoy occupation in Ottawa. Carl Nirenberg reacts to the federal and provincial government's responses to aid Ottawa as it enters the second week of trucker protests. Federal Public Safety Minister Bill Blair stated that the Ottawa police have, quote, the resources they need, end quote, to manage the crisis, despite Ottawa Mayor Jim Watson saying the exact opposite. On the provincial level, the Ford government has chosen to engage in a bit of gaslighting, according to Nirenberg. Watson declares the protest the worst crisis in the city's history and begs the provincial government to intervene. Meanwhile, Ontario Solicitor General Sylvia Jones picked a figure out of the air and said the province had already supplied Ottawa with 1,500 provincial police officers. The Ottawa police chief says that number is closer to 100. All in all, Nirenberg reflects, it is a sad commentary on current Canadian leadership. The leader that is proposing substantive measures to end the convoy is NDP leader Jagmeet Singh. Stephen Wenzel reports on how in the past 2 weeks, Singh has brought forward legislation to ban hate symbols. He passed a motion last week to investigate the role GoFundMe played in the $10 million campaign. He also submitted a four-point plan for the Prime Minister to end the occupation in the capital. Those steps include meeting with the municipal leaders in areas being targeted, like Ottawa, Sarnia, and Coutts, to offer proactive support. Singh also urged Trudeau to touch base with Joe Biden's administration in an effort to shut down the funding coming from the U.S. that is interfering in our democracy. You will find much more coverage and analysis of the Freedom Convoy on the site. Also this week, Kathy Crowe says Toronto's mayor and council's moral compass on homelessness is broken in her piece this week. Crow explains how experts were already critical of Toronto's homelessness issue back in the early 2000s. Nothing was done to combat it. Homelessness grew, the affordable housing crisis intensified, and people continued to suffer and die while remaining homeless. And now, during the 2 years we've been fighting the COVID-19 pandemic, the situation has reached a breaking point. In an article called Tackling Digital Colonialism, Lorenzo Vargas argues that civil society organizations need to be empowered to prevent a new scramble for Africa as tech giants seek to access and monetize data in countries with weak data protection regimes. The 19th century's scramble for Africa enabled colonial powers to take African resources for European benefit. And now, as large tech companies seek to extract and control data from African citizens without their explicit consent, the situation could be considered a form of digital colonialism. In environmental news, David Suzuki poses the question, can carbon capture help resolve the climate crisis? Although carbon capture and storage hasn't really taken off in Canada, Suzuki writes, proposals are mounting from corporations, pipeline companies, and chemical manufacturers. We continue to pump out fossil fuel emissions and destroy our environment. We must change this swiftly. And we must also remove greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere. One solution to do this is to do what plants do, capture carbon dioxide and store it or convert it into something else. Ole Hendrickson reviews Peter Victor's new book, Herman Daly's Economics for a Full World, His Life and Ideas. If you haven't heard of Herman Daly, it's because economists, corporations, and their political lackeys don't want you to, Hendrickson writes. The book recounts Daly's long and distinguished career that spawned the discipline of ecological economics and revealed numerous flaws in neoclassical economics. You can read Hendrickson's full review, along with the full versions of everything we've touched on today, on rabble.ca. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you've got feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, I'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with me anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to Stephen Wenzel and Carl Nirenberg for their reporting this week, and Carl, too, for supplying the music. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. And lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.